Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Here's retired state senator Bob Jauch.
I think the passage of the bill represented a very proud moment to tribes who believed that it recognized that they are entitled to have a future and not just a past.
Chief Seattle once said that mankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. All things are bound together. All things connect.
You're listening to sound from a recent award-winning documentary, Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, an act that, according to one of its sponsors in the state legislature, ensures that Native Americans have a future as well as a past. It is the story of young Indian children who lost their homes, their families, and their cultures by being forcibly placed in foster homes. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we welcome Susan Reitz of Rosinski and Reitz Communication, the producer, director, and writer of Missing Threads, and two of the people it portrays, Loa Porter, recently retired tribal liaison with the Wisconsin Department of Children and Family Services, and a Ho-Chunk woman who was taken from her family at the age of seven. Also, Chris Goodwill, a member of the Menominee tribe who grew up near the reservation and an attorney involved in the practice of Indian law who helped pass the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act. We're also going to listen to some segments of the Missing Threads documentary featuring Eugene Whitefish, chief judge for the tribal court of the Forest County Potawatomi, who was taken from his family at a young age and also placed in multiple foster homes. Now, as always, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Susan Reitz, on the Missing Threads blog, Michelle Danforth is also listed as a producer of the documentary. What role did she play?
Yes. Michelle and I worked along with another friend of ours, James Botsford, on raising the money for the project. And Michelle and I co-directed and kind of went through all the footage after the fact to construct the story.
James Botsford has also been involved with tribal issues for a number of years, and he's been in the news for a different reason. He's been one of the people who's been opposing the Enbridge pipeline running across property in North Dakota. That documentary of yours has won quite a few awards, hasn't it?
Yeah. We're delighted with the reception that it's received. We were fortunate to show the film at several film festivals, a few in Wisconsin, as well as Lincoln, Nebraska, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And at the film festival in Albuquerque, it was chosen Best Short Documentary, which was pretty amazing. It's received a Golden Reel from the Media Communication Association International in the short documentary category, and it has been chosen as one of three finalists for the National Council on Crime and Delinquency's Media for Just Society Award. So we'll find out later in the year where it ranked within those three finalists.
And locally, it's being shown Tuesday, May 24th at the Mercer Public Library?
That is correct, yes.
And you can also see it on the Missing Threads blog. That's Missing Threads, W-I-C-W-A, .blogspot.com. I'm going to give that to you again. It's Missing Threads, W-I-C-W-A, .blogspot.com. Why did you want to produce this documentary?
I, over the years, have done several documentaries dealing with issues related to children, social issues, and that sort of thing. And I had bumped into James Botsford, and we were talking, and he was telling me about this law and how working on it had been such an amazing experience in the process, and just the gravity of what this law does. So as we were talking, you know, the idea for the documentary developed, and we went forward. Michelle joined our team, and we brought on an amazing cinematographer, Brian Alberth, out of the Madison area, and our incredible editor, graphic designer, and sound specialist, Colleen Parquette, out of the Mosinee area.
And it all came together just beautifully. What does the title refer to, Missing Threads?
It refers to the fact that we are each tied to our culture, and when that tie or that thread becomes frayed or broken, there's a really significant impact, a negative impact to the individual, to the culture as well.
And you've got funding provided by the Ho-Chunk Nation, the Forest County Potawatomi Foundation, the Oneida Nation, and the Midwest Child Welfare Implementation Center. What's that last organization?
They were, at the time of the funding, a resource center, a regional resource center. And they had been working with the state of Wisconsin on a grant-funded project for the implementation of the law. And they were nearing the end of that when James and I were talking about this project. So there was some funding remaining in that grant.
Mm-hmm.
And they had wanted to do something as a legacy piece to sort of document their process and just tell the story of this law so that other states looking to do a codification in their own state could use it as a guidepost. So they chose to put their funding into this project, and then the other funders came on board as well.
Chris Goodwill, you're an attorney. You deal with tribal law. You helped to get the act passed in the state legislature. Do you have any idea how many Native American people who are living today in Wisconsin were forcibly removed from their families by social workers? Any concept at all?
I don't know if I can give you an exact number, but I can tell you that they certainly have percentages that came out of the legislative history when the original federal statute was passed in 1978. There were numbers coming out of that legislative history of 25 to 35% of all Indian children were separated and placed in foster homes, adoptive homes, and institutions. The most infamous statistic coming out of Wisconsin was that an Indian child, their chances of being separated from their family was 1,600 times higher than a non-Indian child.
What was the justification for that? What did they say they were doing when they did that to Indian children?
Well, it really goes back to understanding the history of tribes in the United States. I mean, there was a federal policy at one time of termination of federal tribes and assimilating the Indian culture into mainstream culture. A lot of times Indian children were removed because the standards that social workers had in their minds of what a family should be many times didn't meet those standards. I can tell you that in Indian culture, it's very common for us to think of extended family, of including aunts, uncles, great-grandmas. That's a common thing. So for a child to be placed with great-grandma for a week and then live with, you know, Auntie Sue the next week, and then the next month be with a different family is not that uncommon, but it's uncommon.
It's a different culture, and
exactly
the predominant Anglo culture wouldn't accept it, or at least the people in charge. And isn't it ironic that in a country that prides itself of having freedom of religion, freedom of expression, we would have a federal policy of eliminating the tribes and their entire belief systems.
Right. And so things started changing around the time of, you know, when the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed. But then the federal government came into Wisconsin, and I think their report came out in 2003, which really gave the numbers of noncompliance still with this federal statute. The numbers were high in terms of even tribes receiving notice of proceedings that were involving Indian children, even asking the question, do you have Indian affiliation? That was another area of noncompliance. And then once a case was established, the ability or not the ability, but even the consulting with tribes to say, will you work with a reunification plan.
So there was a federal Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed in 1978.
Yes.
And it took decades before Wisconsin passed its own statute.
Yes.
And it's because Wisconsin wasn't in compliance with the federal statute as I understand it, that you and others felt that we needed a Wisconsin statute to fill in the gap.
The tribes in the state of Wisconsin, I think it originally started with there is an Indian Child Welfare Directors group. So every tribe has a director of child welfare, and that group of people, they get together. So the impetus really started with them saying, we really need to do something. And then plus, the Department of Children and Families were certainly made aware of the federal findings.
You're a member of the Menominee Nation. You grew up near the reservation. Did you see any instances of this when you were a child?
I've done a lot of trainings in this field, and one thing that I always say is that I've also worked for three different tribes besides my own tribe. And the thing I always say is that I don't know one Indian family that hasn't been affected by having someone removed. And many times it's that they were removed and never found. And that includes my own family.
And you lobbied to get this passed. You went through a long process to get it passed. And when it did get approved, it got approved unanimously in Madison. That doesn't happen. How did you achieve that?
I think the fact that we took a long time in doing this, I mean, Senator Jouk really put a lot of effort. I mean, his expertise in knowing the political process in Madison certainly helped us. And also, I mean, he had a sit down. We had six negotiating sessions. We had committee hearings before that to basically, you know, have the public testify and give their concerns. But then he held these negotiation meetings too. We identified stakeholders in the state of Wisconsin, which included the District Attorney's Association, which included the Office of the Public Defender, which included the Counties Association. So all of these organizations were identified so that we could sit down and, you know, identify the issues.
And there was some give and take with all those organizations in order to come up with the final wording on the bill.
Yes.
Are there still people who oppose it?
Yes.
Who are they?
I would say mostly it is adoption attorneys. I know that there is a National Adoption Attorneys Association now who is trying to actually still challenge the Indian Child Welfare Act itself and the provisions in it. There's also, I mean, I guess I would say in my experience that it is mostly adoption attorneys.
Loa Porter, the passage of this law is something that meant a great deal to you personally. You were removed from your family at an early age. Tell us about that.
Well, I think in terms of the law itself and its impact to children and how Indian children have been treated in non-tribal homes is devastating. Mm. And I think that is what foremost that we need to protect children from being placed outside the home, outside the tribal community, and that we do as much as we can to minimize any trauma from children leaving the Indian community. I think it's just very, very important to a child's identity, to their connection with their tribe, and to be raised healthy.
You were removed from your home at the age of 7. Tell us about that day.
I remember being at home Christmas Eve. It was snowing out. My mother was telling us to open our presents, that we had to leave immediately, to hurry. There were my brothers and my other two sisters. We piled into a car and drove to my grandmother's house, which was south of Wausau. We got there and to my grandmother's house, and shortly after we arrived, police cars arrived and social workers arrived. My brothers were put into a different car. My sisters and I were put into another car. My mother was standing there. I recall my sister screaming and wanting to go back to my mother. And just us driving away and seeing my mother standing there watching us. And shortly after, she was put into a police car.
You were 7 years old. That's a long time ago. It sounds like you still remember it pretty clearly.
Very, very clearly. And I think that memory stays with me because of thinking about other children. Anytime we remove a child, remembering how that felt to be separated from not only your parents, but your brothers and sisters, and your grandparents.
Were you able to communicate at all with your mother or your grandmother or the other members of your family, your brothers and sisters, after you lost them at the age of seven?
No, no. We were actually—
They wouldn't even let you talk to your own mother?
No. No. We didn't have any communication at all with my mother, anybody in my family, any of my relatives, my grandparents. We were put into an orphanage where we were chosen by people who would take us into foster care. I never knew where any of my brothers went or my sisters went. None of us were able to communicate.
How did that impact you as a young girl, and are you still feeling the effects of it today?
As far as the impact, I think just being utterly alone in the world as a child, because I was put into a white foster home. There were no other Indian children or people around me. I think the effects of that, in terms of the impact today, is relearning. I think over the years is relearning to connect again with my relatives, my brothers and sisters, and my tribe.
That's Loa Porter, a Ho-Chunk woman who was forcibly taken from her family at the age of seven. Chris Goodwill, who worked very hard as an attorney to pass the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, and Sue Reitz, who produced the documentary that we're talking about today, Missing Threads. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. We're going to play an audio clip from the Missing Threads documentary featuring Eugene Whitefish. He's the chief judge for the tribal court of the Forest County Potawatomi. He was also removed from his family at a young age and placed into multiple foster homes. Here Judge Whitefish tells a story of running away from one of those homes at the age of 11.
I ran away from the foster home because I wanted to go home. And I knew if I got out of that home, I would find my way home. And I was only maybe 11 years old. I had the confidence that I would find my way home. They did catch up to me. So I was removed from one foster home into another foster home. Finally, in eighth grade, I was able to see my sister. It was the first time I got to see somebody of one of my family. And when you're young like that, you wonder how come your family doesn't come and see you? Well, for one, my family didn't have a car. They didn't have the money to come see me. When my sister came, she had to take a bus to get here to see me. And it was good to see my sister because that was the first connection I had with my family, basically for 3 years, from age fifth grade and all the way up until eighth grade. And then I didn't see anybody again until I was a sophomore. I went through six different foster homes in a time before I turned 18. I went through six different organized religions. In those six organized religions, it was very confusing because, again, I didn't feel like I fit. When I would sit in these churches, there wasn't any other Native people there. Everything I did, there was no Native people there. There was no people from my culture at all. And needless to say, back then, there was the prejudice. And I was made fun of because I was Indian, because I was Native American. And some of them treated us like slaves. In some of my foster homes, I know the only reason I was there was because they got money to take care of me. The love wasn't there. I learned how to fight. So therefore, when someone made fun of me, and because I was Native American, I didn't care if I hurt him or not. I became a person that didn't know how to feel, and I only operate out of anger. I learned how to block out pain.
It's an audio clip from the Missing Threads documentary featuring Eugene Whitefish, chief judge for the tribal court of the Forest County, Potawatomi. Whitefish says he was forced to attend church services for six different religions, none of which he could identify with as a Native American. Sue Reitz, powerful stuff.
Thank you. Yes, his story and Lois' story are just heartrending.
In the documentary, Whitefish talks about how he was picked up by social workers while he was at school in the fifth grade, and he worried about what his family was thinking when he didn't return home that day.
Yeah, I found that particularly sad. And, you know, what a tragedy for a child to be separated in such an abrupt manner with no opportunity to reconnect, you know, or even say goodbye to their family, and then to have that constant worry and ache that their family didn't know where he was and worried about him and his safety. So things are much better now.
Chris Goodwill, could something like that happen today where the social workers would go into a school and just pluck a fifth grader out of the school and remove him from his family without allowing any contact between them?
Gosh, I hope not. That would certainly be something that would be considered illegal. Today, there's a lot more. I mean, child welfare proceedings are very, very regulated. I mean, there's definitely hearings and proceedings, and there's certain time frames that have to be met with when any child is removed from their family. So today, I mean, that should not be happening. But with the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, too, it's that you contact that child's tribe so that they know. That tribe probably knows more about that child's family than really anybody. A tribal child social worker is going to know that child's family, and also the tribe is a huge resource when it comes to relatives that could take that child.
And Loa Porter, Whitefish also talks about the alienation he felt as the only Indian in classrooms, not seeing members of his family for years at a time, suppressing his feelings and becoming mean as he confronted the prejudice against his people.
Absolutely. I think what Eugene talks about in terms of fighting back, and I myself did, even in second grade, third grade, all the way up through high school, you know, is fighting racism, you know, because in those homes you're not taught to be proud of who you are as an Indian person, but rather shown negativity about being Indian. So many, myself included, children fight back.
Yet he was somehow able to turn his life around and become the chief judge for the Forest County Potawatomi. We're going to take a short break. Our guest today on Route 51, Sue Reitz, she's the producer of the documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, attorney Chris Goodwill, and Loa Porter of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I'm Glenn Moberg. You can join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. Here's Bill Miller.
You for the eagles, the visions and the dreams, the visions and the dreams, the visions and the dreams. Ah, 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 ah.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include UW Credit Union and the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
The music of Peter Phippen taking us into our next segment of Route 51 as we focus on the issues, the history behind the award-winning documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, with our guests Sue Reitz of Rosinski and Reitz Communication, attorney Chris Goodwill, and also Loa Porter of the Ho-Chunk Nation. You can join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg. Let's go to the phones right now. Judith in Wausau, you're on Route 51 with our guests.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, if you know how long, up until what year, the practice of removing Native American children from their native homes went on in Wisconsin.
Chris, why don't you take that?
I would think around the time when it started changing was when the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed, the federal statute.
And that was 1978.
Yes. That's not to say that there was tons of compliance, but that was when it was, you know, the law to contact tribes.
But the law wasn't followed in Wisconsin until you passed the Wisconsin version of that act in 2009.
Right. And I mean, since WICWA went into effect, that was in December of 2009.
WICWA stands for Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act.
Yes, sorry. And there's another organization. It is the Children's Court Improvement Program, who actually, they went around from county to county and determined compliance rates, as well as, you know, the Department of Children and Family did the same thing. Those numbers still don't look that great. So this is still a process. It's still, you know, we're still educating. We're still doing trainings. But at least we have the tool now, so that a tool that's very easily accessible because it's in Chapter 48 of the Children's Code.
Judith, did she answer your question?
Indeed, she did. The reason I asked is because I grew up knowing someone who was Native American. Well, I knew the parents. One was my piano teacher who had adopted a Native American child, and I couldn't quite figure out how that happened because it was disastrous for the child. It was just disastrous. The child wound up institutionalized.
Judith, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate it. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Sue Reitz, any chance of using this documentary, the Missing Threads documentary, to help educate people about this issue?
Well, that's really the main reason for doing it, and we've had a lot of requests from not just Wisconsin but across the country to be able to use the video or the film in terms of educating the general public, states looking to codify the law into their own state law books. It will serve as a guide for them. We're also hoping within Wisconsin that it will be utilized to train judges and attorneys. Social workers in the state of Wisconsin have requested it to use in training their new social workers.
And Loa Porter, you're recently retired as a tribal liaison for the Wisconsin Department of Children and Family Services. Do you see this as being a potential educational tool?
Absolutely. I think one of the current person that's in acting as a tribal liaison is using it as an educational tool for department staff. We're also hoping to integrate it into the professional training development system for social workers as well.
We're going to play another audio clip from the Missing Threads documentary featuring Eugene Whitefish, chief judge for the Tribal Court of the Forest County Potawatomi. He was removed from his family at a young age, placed into multiple foster homes. As we pick up on his story, Judge Whitefish talks about his battle with alcohol and drugs starting at the age of 16.
I continued to use from about the age 16 all the way until I was about 35 years old. By that time, I'd seen in and out of jails. I'd also been in detox centers. I'd been in treatment centers, and it just didn't work. I lost one family that I had a son with because of my alcohol and my drugs. And I had another family that I had a son with, another son. And with my drinking, I destroyed that relationship as well. And I asked my brother to put me in a treatment center. I stayed 6 months in a treatment center. I learned a lot of things. I learned about life. I learned about those feelings that I covered since I was in a foster home that I didn't want to feel. And I vowed that I would never lose track of those feelings again. And to this day, I don't believe I have. So in a treatment center, I had to deal with, I had to open a can of worms with some of the things that I went through in a foster home. The feelings of inadequacy, the feelings of not belonging, the feelings of not being wanted, the feelings of not being loved. I had to open my life and look at everything all over again. And I remember my grandmother telling me, she says, someday, Sonny boy, you're going to go home. She said, you're going to go home and you're going to work for your people. And I thought, well, why would I want to do that? There's no employment around here. She says, you need to get an education. Instead of fighting these people with the hands that you do, you need to fight them with their own medicine. And I said, what do you mean, Grandma? You need to fight them with the education. Get their education and learn to fight them with that.
It's an audio clip from the documentary Missing Threads. Eugene Whitefish would listen to his grandmother. He got an education, began work for his people, first as an alcohol and drug counselor for the Forest County Potawatomi, and then being elected chief judge for the tribal court. Sue Reitz, amazing story.
It is an amazing story, and I'm so appreciative of the people who took the time and were willing to share such a personal aspect of their lives.
And he was willing to open up to you like that, which, I've worked on a lot of video and audio projects. It's not easy for somebody to do that, and he felt it was so important that he did it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have seen this film, I couldn't even count how many times, and that still makes me cry every time we get to that part of the story.
Loy, is Judge Whitefish's story a common one? Did many of the Indian children removed from their families and cultures end up having to suppress their feelings, becoming dependent, in his case, on drugs and alcohol?
I think it's more common than we think. I don't know of a person, a child, who has grown up in foster care who has not had a drug or drinking problem eventually. I was kind of surprised when I did work for the department that a person did come up to me and say, well, they were talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act, and they said, well, we adopted an Indian girl. And they said she was my sister, and right now she had a lot of problems growing up in high school. She turned into an alcoholic and moved away from that family that adopted him.
What was your experience, Lowell?
My experience was using alcohol, some drugs, not heavily into it. One of the things I think that probably redirected my attention was my interest in reading and learning. So I did well in school. I did have stints of drinking, drinking with friends, drinking in college. But I think getting through it and trying to understand behavior, I was always interested in that as well.
How difficult was the path back for you when you returned home? How easy was it for you to relate to your mother, relate to your siblings? Did you even see them after you had a chance to go home again after all of this?
Yes, we were all reunited eventually, about maybe 4 to 5 years later. And it was difficult. I didn't know who or how to relate to my mother. I knew that she was my mother. But I think growing up in foster care and not having that connection to people, that as a child I isolated everything and withdrew, didn't respond to people because there was nothing to respond to with the foster care people.
And how tragic is that? You were so close to her at the age of 7, and then after all of those years, when you finally get back and you're able to reunite with her, it's not the same anymore.
No, no. I think it's real. To me, I think not understanding what happened, but I think having that, having her removed. I remember one time at a foster home that I cried because I missed my mother. I missed her so much that I felt really that my heart had broken. That night I cried so hard as a child. But then again, waking up and forgetting about that pain and just going through the motion of being a child.
Like Eugene Whitefish, you were suppressing your feelings.
Absolutely.
Chris Goodwill, your reaction to what you've just heard.
I think I've talked about the history of tribes, and I think there's a real lack in our general education. I went to public school, and I didn't learn any of this. It wasn't until I actually went to law school and took an Indian law class that I said, holy cow, that explains so much of, you know, my life growing up, you know, very close to my reservation and the conversations that my parents had. But that history is, again, has caused a lot of historical trauma in our communities. I talked about termination. There were also boarding schools. My mom went to boarding school. She was going to be, she was being raised by her grandparents and then placed in boarding school where she didn't see them for months and months. And so it's kind of comparable. And I think some people think that this happened a long time ago. And our documentary and, you know, my story, I'm only one generation removed from that kind of trauma happening.
And Loa is 0 generations removed from it. 1-800-780-9742. We're talking about the documentary produced by Sue Reitz, Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act. Let's go to the phones. Claire in Baraboo, you're on Route 51.
Hi, Glenn. Another great show. I am so moved. I have a question. Is this going to be viewed or aired on Wisconsin Public Television? Is the documentary available for purchase? And then I have a comment.
Let's ask Sue about that, and I should have researched that myself, but I didn't. It should be on Wisconsin Public Television.
There are no immediate plans for it to air on Wisconsin Public Television. I did submit it, and I haven't heard back. It is available on YouTube. Just type in Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, and you can find the film there. You can watch it as often as you want, wherever you want, whenever you want. We are not selling copies of the DVD. We were grateful to receive the funding that we did, and we're not out to make a profit from it. So that's why the link is available to the public on YouTube.
And Claire, you've got a comment?
Well, yes, and one of your two guests, I missed which one, just said this seems like something that would have happened maybe in the 40s or 50s or 60s, but I was shocked when I found out this law did not get changed until 2009. That is shocking and stunning and horrible. I can't believe this has been happening all this time.
Chris Goodwill?
Well, to clarify, there was a federal statute, a federal law that was passed in 1978. And what happened in 2009 is that the federal law was codified into Wisconsin statutes. So as a practicing attorney in the state of Wisconsin, if I went into child welfare proceedings, the lawyers and the judges really look at Chapter 48 in our statutes. And so I would come in and say, wait a second, there's this federal statute that applies here. And so many times they just were not aware of that federal statutes and its provisions.
So Claire, the federal law was passed in 1978 in order to try to fix some of this, but it was not followed very well in Wisconsin until the Wisconsin law was passed in 2009.
That's just disgraceful.
Claire, thanks so much for the comment and the question. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation. We're going to take another short break. Our guest today on Route 51, Sue Reitz, producer of the documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, attorney Chris Goodwill, and Loa Porter of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I'm Glenn Moberg. You can join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. Here is the flag song performed by the singers and drummers of the Menominee Nation.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Cress Funeral and Cremation Services and the Mead Witter Foundation. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Buffy St. Marie with her anthem Up Where We Belong, taking us into the final segment of Route 51 as we focus on the history and the issues behind the award-winning documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act. With our guests, Sue Reitz of Rosinski and Reitz Communication, attorney Chris Goodwill, and Loa Porter of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I'm Glenn Moberg, and let's go to the phones right now. We have a caller from Lincoln County who is on the line right now. And apparently we have lost him. So I'll tell you what we're going to do instead. We're going to go to our final segment right now of clips from the documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act. Judge Eugene Whitefish, now the chief judge for the tribal court of the Forest County Potawatomi, removed from his family at a young age, placed into multiple foster homes. Here, the judge talks about the difference this act, the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, has made for people like him, and an experience that he had later in his life in which he found himself on the other side of the story.
As the chief judge of almost 20 years, well, 20 years now, our children are important. And I was very happy when this law was passed, because I knew another child wouldn't have to suffer the way I did or go through what I did. And I remember the time, the first one that I took, this young man, I had to take him out of his home because they weren't making sure he was being in school. But when I had to take him out of his home, I watched that grandmother in the courtroom cry. The way my grandmother cried. And I watched him cry, and I watched him hold his grandma because I took him out of his home. And when I was done, because I couldn't show any emotion, I walked outside. And in my teachings, I put my tobacco down. And I knew that that was me maybe 25, 30 years before that. But only I wasn't given the ability to cry. I wasn't given the ability to hug my grandmother goodbye because I was snatched up and just put in a foster home. I wasn't able to say goodbye to my grandma because the system was different. But as I sit as a judge on this day and today yet, what we have now protects our children so they don't have to feel the way I felt or experience the things I had to. Because now that Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act protects our children. So this day as I sit in court, I know the reason that my life has transpired and the paths I walk, because no book could teach me what I have learned by the path I have walked.
Lowell Porter, Judge Whitefish, saying no book could teach me what I have learned by the path I have walked.
Yes, I think that's very fitting for this type of experience. It is a hard road to walk alone. And I think that's what Indian children do when they're removed without following the law. And I think not following the law takes away that child's identity to the tribe, to the beauty, to the balance that they can learn from their family, from their tribe, from their community.
Sue from Tomahawk, from Lake Tomahawk, says the documentary should be mandatory for workers at hospitals that treat Native Americans. Sue worked at a hospital in northern Wisconsin. She says racism is still very common. We can squeeze in just one more phone call. Here's Cheryl from Conover. Cheryl, you've got to make it fast. We're running out of time.
I am. Thank you very much for my call. I am so moved by your show. I will look at that YouTube video, and I will practice it in my practice of real estate. I sell real estate in northern Wisconsin, and I'm going to tell you something right now. It's time. It is time and long time in this coming. Thank you very much for your show today.
Thank you, Cheryl, for the call. Chris Goodwill, any final thoughts?
Well, I wanted to mention one thing about that the Midwest Child Welfare Implementation Center, one of the things that they did is that they did trainings after the act was passed. And now that's over. But we still need to do more trainings with people like Loa, Judge Whitefish, people who worked on getting this law passed. It has to be an ongoing effort.
Sue Reitz.
I agree with Chris. This needs to be an ongoing effort. And if you go to the blog that Glenn mentioned earlier, there are links to some of the items that were created as part of the Midwest Child Welfare Implementation Training Project. So share the information as much as you can.
And Loa, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
We want to thank today's guests, Susan Reitz of Rosinski and Reitz Communication, attorney Chris Goodwill and Loa Porter of the Ho-Chunk Nation, audio segments from the documentary Missing Threads, the story of the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, featured Chief Judge Eugene Whitefish of the Forest County Potawatomi. You can find out more about the documentary and view it on the Missing Threads blog at missingthreads.blogspot.com. There's also a link to it on the Route 51 Facebook page. And you can find out more about Rosinski and Reitz Communication at RosinskiReitz.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by the singers and drummers of the Menominee Nation, Peter Phippen, Buffy St. Marie, and Bill Miller. Next Thursday on Route 51, we mark the 50th anniversary of CAP Services of Stevens Point. Our guests include the organization's executive director, Mary Patoka, and Sister Simone Campbell, the executive director of Network. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.
Granddad, I've walked way beyond that reservation. Have you ever walked on a reservation road? Let me take you down a reservation.